Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm very happy now to welcome Pam Wiseman. She is Executive Director of the New Mexico Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. Thanks for having me.
So this is pretty heavy-duty work that you do. How did you get into working in the whole field of domestic violence?
Sure, really. I guess quite by accident. When I graduated from college, which was in the early 1980s, it was also a recession, not like this recession perhaps, but it was a recession. And I had my degree in psychology, and I went to look for a job, and I couldn't find one. And so I did a little stint at a Chinese restaurant and, you know, folded boxes for a factory in town, and then saw an ad in the paper for a domestic violence shelter case management job. And I had no idea what that was, but I applied for it. I didn't get it. They said, why don't you volunteer for a while? And I decided to do that, and then ultimately was hired. But for a number of years, actually, I thought that the only experience I had with domestic violence was what I had learned from working there. And as I look back, I realized that I knew many, many people and had many experiences related to domestic violence.
How did you not know that, if I may ask?
Yes. That's a really good question. I think the fact is that domestic violence is pervasive every place, in Santa Fe, in Albuquerque, in small rural towns all across the country. But we have this certain way that we look at it, as if domestic violence was something that you would see on an episode of Cops. And that's how I saw it. It's something that happens to people who maybe are poor and who drink a lot. It never occurred to me that lots and lots of people had that experience, because I had this idea about domestic violence, which is that it was, you know, people with black eyes, and it's so much more than that, and it's so much more insidious, and it's subtle. For example, when I was in high school, I had a boyfriend. He was kind of a tortured soul, actually. He liked to listen to country music, and he was very dramatic, and he'd cry, and anyway, his mother was a person who was very depressed, and she drank, I thought, and always seemed not really there. And I went to her after a particular incident occurred, and I asked her about it. And here's the incident. One evening, my boyfriend and I were out, and he was mad because he thought I was looking at other men or something. And no matter what I said, it didn't matter. That's what he thought had happened. So he took me to this place. It was in the middle of the night. It was called County Park. And if you were going to, you know, bury a body someplace in my area, it probably would have been in County Park. And he dropped me off in the middle of the night by myself. And I had to go...
As a punishment for looking at other
men. Right, as a punishment. But he was very upset, right? He was insecure, and how could I do that to him? And so I told his mother about this incident, and she said to me, well, Pam, you know, these are the kinds of things that happen when you don't pay close enough attention to the ego needs of your men, right? So she basically said, go back and try harder, because if he wasn't insecure, he wouldn't have done that.
And it was your fault that he was insecure, in her mind.
I had contributed to it. It was my job. Maybe it wasn't my fault that he was insecure, but it was certainly my job to make sure that he wasn't in the future. You know, and later on...
Wait, can I just ask you,
yeah,
did you break up with him?
No. No, I did not. In part because I listened to his mother,
yeah.
And I thought, well, that's probably true. I mean, what did I know, right? I was 18. I wasn't even 18. But there was at one point where his father had taken a gun. I mean, this is sort of, as I'm saying this, I'm thinking, are you kidding me? You didn't understand this. They had this gun case in their living room. It wasn't his, and his father had taken out one of the guns. My boyfriend got the gun. Actually, I think it was a rifle. And he had his dad down on the ground, and he told him to leave his mother alone. And I walked out of the house and went down. They lived on a lake. Went down to the lake. That was all over. Didn't say very much about it. And that was the end of that, right? In addition to that,
You know, these are the kinds of incidents that when you're a kid, an adolescent, 17, 16, 18 years old, and they happen, and you don't have a place in your mind to put it somehow. You don't know a category that fits into. You don't have anybody making a judgment on it. It goes into some weird nonverbal place, and you don't, 5, 10 years later, characterize it as domestic violence.
Nobody talked about domestic violence then. Nobody. I don't know if I even really knew the word. Maybe I'd watch The Burning Bed or something. But it was not, you're right, I didn't have a context for it. So I didn't know what to do with it. But we had these friends. We used to double date, Larry and Debbie. Larry was he's a football player. He was very popular. He was funny. I liked him a lot. His girlfriend, Debbie, the same way. And my boyfriend and I used to double date with them. And one night, there was some sort of fight, some teenage drama, right? That's how I saw it then. Everybody was drinking. And Larry was banging Debbie's head against a tree. We didn't call the police. It didn't occur to anyone. It didn't really even occur to anyone that that was anything all that unusual, you know. Later on, they got married, and they had a child together, and Debbie tried to break up with Larry, and Larry was having no part of that. Larry began cruising around her house with a loaded rifle, and the police were called several times, but back in those days, there was no such thing as an order of protection. There was really nothing. The police said, well, if we see him do something, we'll come. And of course, they didn't. And so one morning, while she was getting ready for work, he came into her house, and he shot her, and he killed her in front of their daughter.
Oh, my goodness.
And he then drove into a... someone called the police. He drove into a bank parking lot, and the police had him surrounded, and he was armed, and they shot and killed him. And that, you know, that's a tragic, intense story. Could it have been prevented? I think probably, had we known what this was, but nobody took it seriously. It was just a non-issue.
Well, that's a long answer for how did you get into doing domestic violence work.
Yeah, and I mean, this didn't register with me, right? He killed her many years later, right? But none of these things as I was getting this job occurred to me as being domestic violence. I had a family friend who had an eating disorder, a very close family friend. Her sister had fibromyalgia, right, which are where it's painful to be touched, where it's painful really just to exist. My friend was very insecure. If anyone was cooking fish in the room, she would have to leave. And she loved to shop and buy lots of clothes. And I once asked her about that. It's like, because she didn't really have the money for that. What's that about? And she said, well, I just feel so ugly that it's important that I do whatever I can to, you know, to not be in what in her mind was just, you know, a dog. And after their father died, my friend's father and her sister, I found out that they had grown up in an abusive home. I had no idea. I knew the parents. Didn't seem that way to me. And every mealtime was a source of drama and abuse. And so they grew up not wanting to eat. And the smell of fish, because the father was a fisherman, was something that persisted. And their daughter then grew up many years later, right, to be afraid, to have bipolar disorder, to have an eating disorder. So for many, many generations, right? And this had all been going on under our noses, and we didn't put those things together, right, to see that they were really connected. I have a lot of examples. I have yet another one just to sort of show that I really, you know, when I thought I didn't know anyone, in fact, I knew lots of people. My own mother. My mother was afraid of lots of things, you know, this sort of thing like, don't lean on the door, you're going to fall out, right? And she transferred, I think, some of that to me. My daughter would say that I wouldn't let her eat hard candy until she was 12, and that's probably true. So I inherited some of that. But she was nervous, and when she died, her sister came to the funeral and said, you know, your mother stood up to a rapist. And I said, no, I didn't know that. And it led me to understand that maybe she had stood up to them, but not successfully. And suddenly.
Oh, you don't know.
And you don't know. That's right.
I didn't know.
No, she died. So I never did know, but it makes me understand better why she was the way that she was, you know, and that then has become generational. So I knew lots of people, and I had lots of experience with domestic violence, even though I thought I had none. And I'm sure that most other people do too. They just don't know it. Or as you said, they don't have the context for it. They don't see it as domestic violence, but in fact, that's what it is. I spent until I was 10 years old in New Jersey. When I was 10, we moved sort of quickly and unexpectedly to Michigan. And again, I didn't find out why that had happened until my mother died, and again, her sister told me why I lived in Michigan. And the reason was that my dad had a friend who he worked with, and our families were friends, and we would go over there all the time. And one day, this colleague of my dad's wanted me to help him with something, getting chairs out of a room or something. And I did, and he molested me. And I don't want to make light of it and say, oh, it wasn't bad, because any level of molestation is bad. But it wasn't as bad as it could have been, and I didn't really know what it was. And so on the way home, I said to my parents, guess what Mr. so-and-so did? And I could see my mother look at my dad like, you know, and it occurred to me that was whatever that was probably not a good thing, right? And I'd also left my stuffed animals at their house, right? So that's how young I was, little stuffed animals. So we got home, my dad called him and said, we're not friends, I hate you kind of thing, and my daughter wants her stuffed animals back. And then several months later, we lived in Michigan.
So you moved because a friend of your father's had molested...
Yes, but I did not know that. No one ever said that. I just know what I found out was that he, of course, could not work with him anymore and couldn't find a way to do that. So we picked up and we moved because of it.
We're talking to Pam Wiseman, who's the director of the New Mexico Coalition Against Domestic Violence. So here we are talking about domestic violence, and these are some real examples. I would think that our wonderful listeners who are hearing this program might say, what is domestic violence? How do you even define it?
That's a good question. There are lots of ways to define it. There's physical abuse, there's sexual abuse, there's emotional abuse. One of the things we know from the research is that the most powerful, the most devastating brand of abuse is psychological abuse. The kind, in fact, specific kinds, such as belittling people, humiliating people, making them feel insignificant and like nothing, that is much worse for people and lasts longer than black eyes. So domestic violence is, in the way that we think about it, an attempt of one person to really have power and control over another person. And sometimes that can be achieved through sarcasm, insults, threats. Sometimes it can be achieved through physical violence. But the impulse is really always the same, and it's to control someone else.
What are some of the reasons why people do that in the first place? I mean, it's the vast majority is men toward women. Is that correct?
Yes, over 90%.
So what's going on in the minds of these people? I know that you've actually worked with groups of abusers.
Yes. I wish that I could say, you know, that I know what was in their minds. I don't. But what I can say is that there's a real similarity between them, almost as if they all read the same book, you know, How to Abuse Someone, you know, and they all checked it out of the library, because they're very similar. But, I mean, what they say about it is that they had to do it because somebody was not acting properly. They do it to keep people in their places. Many of them deny that they did anything wrong. I just heard a story. Someone told me about a case where a woman was set on fire and later said that she did it to herself. And I've heard many, many abusers say that, you know. It's like she hit herself. She threw herself down the stairs. One man said she flew out the door. He kicked her. Like, she flew out the door, did she really? And they also do it, I think, because we have allowed it, permitted it, condoned it. in not just in this culture, but in lots of cultures, the abuse of women is considered not very serious. And I think if I were to say that includes this country, people would be upset. They'd say, of course we take that seriously. But yet, when you look at the criminal justice system, for example, and I think they're all sort of doing the best they can, but, you know, if you were in the mafia and you were going to testify against someone, right, you'd get a fake name and a new identity and you'd have Secret Service and marshals all around you, right, there'd be a lot of care taken. But if you're being threatened by someone that you live with, by your husband in your own home, what's more likely to happen is that they're going to make you stand next to that person in front of a judge and they're going to say, why can't you two get along, or something like that. And so every message that we give both to victims and to batterers is that it's not a serious crime. I think despite what we think we believe about it, our actions really say something else.
You said a moment ago that it's almost as if these guys had all read the same book.
Right.
What's on the checklist in this hypothetical book? Like, what do they do that's all the same?
They all have a similar way of denying it, right? That's the first thing. That's either I didn't do it at all, right? I don't know how she got all bruised up, or I did it, but it wasn't very bad. You know, she said I really hurt her. I just, you know, tapped her, I did it, but she deserved it, would be another one. It's all about the justification. That's basically the message that the abusers provide. Yeah, maybe I did something, but you don't understand. If you were married to her, you would have done a lot worse, or you would have done the same. So it's really about holding the victim responsible for what happens to her. There's a real reluctance to admit to having been violent. I mean, you think, well, that's sort of an obvious thing, right? Why would you admit? And perhaps that's true, but it's very strong.
It has really only within, I think, your and my lifetime been the case that women can get restraining orders and orders of protection, and that there are rape crisis centers and battered women's shelters and things like that to go to. How did this movement start?
It really started, it sort of came out of the sort of women's consciousness raising, you know, in the 60s. And it was very grassroots. There was this recognition that men were committing lots of violence against women. Women had no place to go. People started putting victims up in their own homes. And then it sort of slowly evolved into what we have now, which is a shelter system all around the country, several thousand of them.
And along with actual resources for women who can go to these places and have safety and have the law on their side, there's also a real, as you say, you know, the consciousness-raising movement of the old days, change in consciousness to getting rid of the idea that you did something wrong in the first place. I mean, that's a huge part of this.
Right. We spend a lot of time trying to help people understand that they did not cause the abuse. But that's very difficult, in part because batterers are so good at assigning responsibility and blame to their victims, and victims tend to believe it, and they question themselves, what have I done, you know, what can I do differently? It's very powerful, and they're very good at manipulating the emotions of their victims.
When you see people who are victims of domestic violence, women in particular, to what extent would you say that they come from homes or environments where that was around them, where that was considered the norm, or where it even happened, where that was the norm?
Yeah. Statistics are mixed. You know, the research is mixed on that. It appears that almost anyone is vulnerable to becoming a victim of domestic violence, that you don't have to have come from that kind of a home. Although there is some research to suggest that men who came from those homes are more likely to be to offend as well. There's a study that really brings home the consequences of having grown up in that kind of a family. One of the things that we know is that domestic violence, whether it's physical, sexual, or emotional, is not only common, but the effects are lifelong. And they are effects that are stunning. I've been surprised a couple of times since I started working in this field. The first time I was surprised was when I realized that I knew all these people who had been victims of domestic violence. And the second time was just a few years ago, really, and I've been in this field for 25 years, when I realized all the really negative effects of domestic violence on families. I heard a person talk who actually will be coming to a conference that we're having in Albuquerque in the fall. And she talked about a study in which 18,000 people were participants, which is a lot of people, right? That's a credible study. It was done by the Centers for Disease Control and Kaiser Permanente in California. And they looked at childhood exposure to physical, sexual, and emotional abuse. And what they found was that having been exposed to abuse as a child seemed to be significantly correlated with the onset of diseases later in life, such as heart disease, cancer, stroke, lung diseases, asthma, substance abuse, diabetes. So the worst problems we face in this country, the most expensive problems we face, seem to be tied to the presence of domestic violence in the home.
So basically, I mean, what I would extrapolate from that, tell me if this is right or wrong, is that the psychological stress of that messes with your immune system.
That seems to be part of it. They don't know exactly what that is. That's part of it. And it also, the stress of it, for example, might cause you to smoke, right? To start smoking, and then you wind up with lung cancer. Or to drink, and then you wind up with diabetes.
Or to overeat.
Or all those kinds of, right. So it's not, domestic violence is not a small issue over here in the corner. It's not something that happens just a few people. It happens to lots of people. In fact, in this study, what they found was that two-thirds of these people had had one exposure in their lifetime. So we are subjecting two-thirds of our children to abuse and condemning them, really, to a lifetime of illness and early death. In fact, people who had more than one exposure, which was most people, die on average 20 years before their counterparts who've had no exposure.
20 years?
20 years.
That's a really long time.
Yes, it is.
Given that the life expectancy of most people is what? It's late 70s
something.
Or early
yeah,
80s, whatever?
That's right.
That's crazy.
They die 20 years before. So this is a problem of such magnitude that, to me, it's stunning. And what's really stunning, I'm glad I'm able to be here and to talk to you about it, is that the people who conducted this study, who published it and so on in various journals, have said that the press isn't very, has not been very receptive to this. They don't want to cover this. And
I wonder why.
I think because it's so awful. And because it's so common, it's easier to talk about dogs on ice, I suppose, right, than it is to talk about a problem this big, because what do you do to fix it, you know?
Although that's what the press is for. It's not to talk about puppy dogs and cupcakes.
I know, but we... right, that's right, but the press does talk about that, right? And I should think this would be the headline in every newspaper. The news, every news show should start with this. Like, do you realize that the worst problems we face in this country are tied to domestic violence, right?
Well, it's also, I think, a very important point to internalize and think about is the ways in which things like healthcare costs are completely interrelated with what happens in the privacy of the bedroom and things like in the privacy of the home, in terms of somebody hitting somebody else.
That's right. Right. These are not just isolated incidents. They happen in a vacuum, you know, no big deal. They affect all of us. We know, for example, that over 90% of the women and children who are homeless have had domestic violence somewhere in their past. It may not be the precipitating incident, but it certainly is involved, right? And that's a huge problem, you know, all over the country. So I think we haven't focused on it in the way that, you know, we really need to. I was in Silver City month or so ago, I was touring all the shelters around New Mexico. And in this particular program, I talked to the children's therapist there. And she was wonderful, right, and does such fabulous work with these kids. But she said, you know, she told me this story about this little boy and, you know, how he had suffered really serious abuse, and he kept getting sent back, which is one of the problems in the criminal justice system, that kids repeatedly get sent back to live with the people who are abusing them. And so he'd get sent back and then come back to her, and she'd work with him. And then he got cancer, and he died eventually. And she said, you know, it just gets in their cells. And I thought, you know, she's right. And that there seems to be that connection, right?
We're talking to Pam Wiseman, Executive Director of the New Mexico Coalition Against Domestic Violence. So, breaking the cycle, how do you do it?
We don't know nearly enough about how to do that. But, I mean, there's both the sort of micro level and the macro level, right? On a micro level, we need to, I think, work with children. And if we can prevent the effects of domestic violence, either because we stop it in the home or because we work with them in therapy to stop it from turning into this, then that's a first step, and that's really important. But the money is often not there to be able to do that, right? We try to just provide basics and shelter for people, but a lot of money needs to be invested, I think, in helping kids heal from the abuse that they suffer. We need to get them out of the places where they're being abused, and we need to hold the offenders accountable. That's sort of working with individual people. But then we also have to change our systems. We have to really start taking this more seriously. It's severe, and it just hasn't been addressed it hasn't been given the attention, really, and the money that it deserves. We spend money on lots of stuff, right? If we can buy some airplanes, and, you know, why can't we spend money on therapists to help these kids or advocates?
We live in a society that puts a lot of respect toward our violent institutions, if I may be so blunt,
Absolutely.
Which is, you know, military and police and people who carry
That's right.
arms.
That's
and
right.
we have a lot of movies about that kind of violence, and people seem to like them. What effect do you think that has? I'm not saying it does, because I don't know, but is there a relationship between those things?
I think it's enormous. I mean, on the one hand, you know, when I would work with batterers, here I am in this basement, dingy old basement classroom, right, with a piece of chalk and a pencil, trying to end violence, when all around me and all around them, they could see quite clearly that violence is not something to be avoided. It's something that we celebrate, that we reinforce, that we reward, right? If you are the president of the United States and you go to war, you become a hero, right? Violence is something we like. We believe in controlling other countries and making them submissive. I think that it's intimately connected, and so it's very hard for to say to a child, "Don't, you know, hit someone," when they can see, you know, the sort of flags flying and missiles, you know, surrounded by guns and ammunition and going to war and all the, you know, the excitement that accompanies that. I think, you know, when we went to war this last time in Iraq, we saw that very clearly, right? It was something that really moved people. And yet it was violent. And so those are mixed messages.
Well, it moved people in a lot of different ways. I mean,
some
people were gung-ho in favor of it. And, the question, I mean, this probably has yet to be studied, but is what is the effect on the children of the people who were gung-ho about it? And it was also, it generated the biggest anti-war
That's
protests
true.
In history. And, you know, people are saying no, too. But
yeah.
the way those... I mean, I guess it's just really, I'm asking this not because there's a definitive answer, but because it's worth thinking about.
I think it's critical that we think about it. We don't very often. I actually have given a lot of thought to this issue and the way in which our institutions and our cultures send messages about the acceptability of violence, particularly against women. And it's just very hard to try to send another message, particularly on an individual level when everyone can see plain as day that violence is not something that we try to avoid.
And I think one of the things that is difficult for women is coming out of the closet, so to speak, taking something that for them has been intensely private and that they're trying to work out themselves and bringing it into whether it be the system or into public or into their friends outside the family or whatever and trying to get help.
Right, and I think, I mean, there are lots of reasons for that, right? I mean, in, I don't remember which country this was, but for example, if a woman alleged abuse against her husband and she went to court, she has to produce 5 male witnesses that can corroborate her story. And if she fails to do that, then she will be stoned, right? So I'm not suggesting that that's what we do, but when people go to court, it's very difficult to prove, and women are often asked, you know, they're accused of, people think they're lying, they think they're making it up, they think it's not as bad as they say it is, they think they're using it somehow,
and that's still true today?
It's still true today, yes. There are lots of, those beliefs are still there, despite decades of our trying to reform the system and trying to teach people about this, they're still there. And I don't know if it's our approach, and I think that's something we should look at. It might be. I mean, maybe we've been accusatory, and maybe that hasn't helped, you know, because domestic violence is harmful to every one of us. We may not recognize that. Even the people who perpetrate it and who seem to get lots of benefits from it, in the end, they're harmed by it, too. I mean, really no good comes from it. And I think maybe we haven't been as persuasive as we should have been in getting that point across. Because even though there have been reforms, there have not been nearly enough. This story that I told you about the woman in Silver City, she said, you know, I don't know how much longer I can do this. And I can understand that. And I said, what is that about? What specifically do you really find the most disturbing? And she said, it's the criminal justice system. That's what she said. She said, I work with these kids and they keep getting sent back. And she said, I don't know how much longer I can take that. And she's right. That's what happens. We have a criminal justice system that tries. I'm not, you know, being critical, but it's set up to deal with episodes of criminality. It's not set up to look at patterns of violence, you know, over a long period of time. And so it's not, doesn't work, you know, very well. And when women do decide to prosecute or get an order of protection, sometimes that just makes things worse for them. And the system is not set up to protect them. It's just not. And so most women will say, I didn't follow through with the charges because I didn't want to get killed. And so it's a survival issue. And I think we've just failed really to understand that. And I think we've also failed to engage our communities. And so we're doing some things at the coalition at the state level to try to change that.
Tell us more about the New Mexico Coalition Against Domestic Violence. What are some of the things you're doing?
Okay. Well, the Coalition Against Domestic Violence is we're made up of 29 member programs from all around the state.
Santa Fe.
Including Santa Fe, which is, you know, Esperanza and Taos and Raton, Albuquerque, Las Vegas. We have programs all over the state. And so our coalition works on legislative issues and training and sort of giving that group one voice to be more effective around the state. But one of the initiatives I think that we're trying to implement is court watches. You have one here in Santa Fe, and there's also one in Rio Rancho. Those are the two that I know about in the state at the moment. We'd like to have more because those court watches engage the community. They're an opportunity for the community to go into the courts and see for themselves what's going on.
What is a court watch? What does that mean?
Yes. Well, for example, in the area where I came from originally, before I moved to New Mexico, I started a court watch in my area. And I did it because the judges, in particular in this area, were very disparaging of victims. They would say, for example, one judge would always say to every victim who came into his courtroom who wanted to get an order of protection, he would say, "Ma'am, if you're lying to me on any portion of this petition, I'm going to send you to a place where you're going to make little rocks out of big rocks." He didn't say that to the batterer, right? He said that to the victim. There was another judge who said to a woman who had been doing something he didn't approve of, "If I was your husband, I might have done the same thing." Right? I mean, and much worse than that. I mean, those are just mild examples. And so those of us who work in the field have been seeing this for years and years. And the advocates who go into the courts, it's demoralizing, you know, to have to hear about these kinds of stories. And so I thought, you know, maybe we need to involve the community in this. Maybe we need to train them. Let them go into the court. Let them hear what's really happening. And let them report that to the press. So it's not the usual suspects, right? It's not the domestic violence advocates. It's the community.
So basically an ordinary person, housewife, whatever, person with a job, can sign up for Court Watch, go into court, watch the whole scene in action, and then they report it, and the press will write a story about it?
That's the way it has worked. I mean, there are various models, and everybody's is different. The model that I used was really a community organizing model, right, where they would go into the courts, they'd write down what they saw, what they heard, and they would make a very public report. The press would cover it. And the community was becoming educated, and they were shocked, right? The things that were just normal to us, they found appalling.
And so then would the judges change their ways?
Absolutely. And they did it quickly. It didn't take years and years. Did they change their beliefs? I don't know. Did they change their behaviors? Yes, they did.
And, you know, I think that's a very important point, is that you don't have to change your beliefs. If you change your behaviors, then society functions. That woman won't be traumatized by the person who's supposed to protect her,
that's
whatever
right.
he may think.
That's right.
And
that's
she
right.
can go on with her life.
That's exactly right. It was, yeah, in fact, some of them were converted in a sense. We had judges, they didn't want to get training in my area, right? And because they said it would interfere with their impartiality. To which I said, ignorance is not the same as impartiality. If you don't, you know, it's not often considered a good thing in many professions to not know what you're talking about, right? And so here you are trying to make these life and death decisions for people, and you don't know anything about it, right? I mean, that's not okay. So they got training. And now they send other judges to training, and it helped. But I think it's really, Court Watch is about motivation, right? It's helping people to understand why they should care about what happens in the courts, because it matters. For all the reasons that I just talked about, you know, for the effects on children, there's a woman in Chicago, her name is, I think her last name is Blumenfeld. She works with trauma victims, and you know, she was telling a story at a conference I was at recently, where there was a little girl who was having nightmares that her mother was being followed and was going to be killed, which, of course, was probably happening. And they had stopped, and they started again. And so they wanted to find out what had happened to make them start again. And apparently the father, the batterer, had been calling to talk about an upcoming court date, which started again. And then as the court case got nearer and she was going to have to be there, she actually began to have these dreams while she was awake. They found her falling down on the playground and all of that. So she was being seriously traumatized again, right? This was in Chicago, seriously traumatized by the courts, in a sense, right, who were probably trying to do the right thing, but were just unaware of the terrible, terrible effects on these children of that. And so,
what could the courts have done differently?
Oh, there are all kinds of things. I think when children are abused, it often, the courts look at the rights of the parents, and that includes, you know, the rights of the fathers. And I think it's good for kids to have two parents. I would never disagree with that. But it's not good for kids to be continuously exposed to abuse. And so more attention needs to be paid to that. It all costs money. I understand that. You need custody evaluators and psychologists and expert witnesses, but it's something that's really important. And so I think changing the systems where these that interact with victims and children will, in the end, make a big difference. And so that's why I think community engagement issues like Court Watch really matter, you know.
You are working with a model called the Sanctuary Model. What's that about?
What that is, it's a trauma-informed model. And what that means, to sort of sum it up in just a sentence, is that when you're doing trauma-informed services, you're not asking the question, what's wrong with you? But you're asking the question, what happened to you, right? Why... You know, so behavior then is viewed in that context, right? That maybe you do have an eating disorder, maybe you, whatever, all these problems that people have, it's based on what happened to you, not because there's some internal defect. And it's just, it seems like not much of a shift, but in fact it is. And the other piece of that is that people who work with victims of trauma, organizations become traumatized themselves.
Yeah.
And they begin to exhibit lots of the same characteristics that you see traumatized people exhibiting. And so in this model, these people work with whole organizations to make sure that they are safe and emotionally healthy for everyone involved, not just the clients, but staffs, boards, and even communities.
We're talking to Pam Wiseman, Executive Director of the New Mexico Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Pam, you've written a book, and I know that you did not select the title, but you did.
Right.
You did write the book.
I did write the book.
You did write the content of the book, and
yeah.
It's called Ditch That Jerk,
right.
Dealing with Men Who Control and Hurt Women. So obviously this came out of your experience working in the field of domestic violence. This is a self-help book. This is a how-to book. What do you tell people? What's going on? How do you actually empower women to leave bad situations?
Yeah. The reason I wrote the book was because one night I was doing a batterers group. It was a cold winter night, and one of the men's partners was out in the car with little kids, right, waiting for him to get out with the car running. It was a two-hour group, right? She bundled up all the kids and brought him there because she thought, good, this is a chance. Maybe he'll change. But he was downstairs, not talking about, wanting to change, but making fun of her and talking about how she deserved what she got and that sort of thing. And I thought to myself, wouldn't it be nice if I could tell her, which of course I couldn't, but if I could tell her what was really going on. Here she is waiting for this guy to change, and he's in there, you know, saying awful things about her. So I decided to write a book, and in the book I told people what really happens in abuser groups. So it was really written for victims. These are the things that they say. This is what goes on. And this is how you might know whether someone's going to change or not.
And how do you know whether someone's going to change or not?
Well, yeah, I wish, you know, you really don't. I mean, in many respects, you really don't. But the greater the number of problems, the more unlikely it is that people will change. So if you have someone who's got substance abuse problems and other criminal behavior, in addition to being a batterer, those people, it's harder for them to change, and it's more unlikely, right? Someone who's a sociopath is not going to change. We don't know really how many people do change, but it's a small number. It's a relatively small number. It's about what you'd expect from people changing who go to therapy, you know. And the research is mixed on this. But
I had a friend who was a therapist, and she said to me one day, not even in the context of her profession, she just said to me, no one ever changes.
Yeah, that's a sad state of affairs, isn't it? Yeah, I wouldn't go that far. I mean, if we thought no one ever changed, then we wouldn't do the work. Some people do.
Well, I think what changes is cultural norms. So
right.
The judges don't say what they say anymore, or women don't put up with it. I mean, I think a lot of it is what you said at the beginning, teaching women that they don't have to put up with this stuff anymore, and teaching them that as kids.
Right, right. Teaching them they don't have to put up with it, but also offering them options. Women don't have very many options, right? This woman who was sitting in the car with her three kids, right? She probably didn't work. He's her only source of support. Where's she going to live? Where's she going to go? So I think we need to pay more attention to that, too. Because we say, why don't you leave? But, you know, for what and to where, you know?
So we've got a few minutes left. Let's talk more about the work that the New Mexico Coalition Against Domestic Violence is doing.
Sure. Well, one of the things we're doing is trying to work with various state agencies and other groups to develop standards and trainings for batterers programs, because it's very important that those programs don't make problems worse.
Do they sometimes?
Sometimes they do. That is my feeling. And yes, I think they can make things worse. They can make things worse by colluding, really, with the people who are a part of the group.
So you've got a group of batterers who all say, yeah, I feel that way too, and then it reinforces them?
Exactly. It can have a really negative effect.
That's horrible.
Right. So, like, you know, I would walk into a room, there'd be 15 men there, and I'd say, how many of you didn't do anything wrong and don't belong here? All of them would raise their hands, all the time, really, right? They'd laugh and make jokes about it, because to them, because they haven't suffered the way their partners have suffered, right? And so it's easy to laugh about it. So it's important that groups really hold people accountable. Don't let them minimize it and justify it and make it seem like a joke. Because when that happens, that often makes violence worse. I mean, you'd better to not do anything at all than to go into a group and give implicit support.
Have you ever seen a breakthrough moment where somebody suddenly has a moment of empathy where they saw what they did wrong and put themselves into the shoes of their victim?
Yes, I have. We had some specific exercises that we actually used to facilitate that, right? Because everybody knows what it's like to feel powerless, whether it's, you know, against, you know, whether it's the IRS or it's your boss or it's whatever, right? Everybody understands that. And so we would talk about those issues and then say, you know, and really get men to talk about how they feel about their place in society and what that's like and what they think of themselves and what they think about the people who are on the top in society. And then we'd say, what about your wives and your girlfriends and your partners? You know, how do you think they feel when they're down there where you are? And it is definitely an epiphany for some of them. Absolutely. I think they just haven't thought of it before. So the Coalition Against Domestic Violence, NCADV, you know, we work on lots of issues, policy issues. We recently, in fact, I just got back from Washington, D.C., where we talked to most of the members of the New Mexico delegation about some of the things we were talking about here today. And they were all really interested in seeing what else we could do. And so at our conference, we're going to be focusing on a little bit on children's issues and on how to create these safe organizations. And my hope is that New Mexico can then become kind of a leader in this area. Because as I talk to people from around the country about this model, the sanctuary model, and what we want to do here, there was a lot of national interest in it. People from all over the country said they wanted to come to hear more about it. So I'm hoping that we can, you know, position New Mexico to really do something significant.
Before we go, I want to end with a question for you, which is that if somebody's listening to the program now and they've got either a problem themselves with somebody who is hurting them, either emotionally or physically or both, in their home, or they know somebody who's in that position who's talked to them, what should they do?
Well, the first thing that they should do is understand that it's not their fault. I know that most people don't believe that. They go, yeah, you all say that. But it's true. It's not their fault. The second thing is, there is help available. There are shelters and programs all over the state of New Mexico that are, you know, 24 hours a day that stand willing to help. The third thing is, you don't have to do anything that you don't want to do. If you decide you don't want to leave because it's not the right time, then that's your decision. It doesn't mean there's something wrong with you or that you're bad. Everybody has to decide on their own and in their own time what they're going to do. But there is help, and don't be afraid to call.
And even if you do not have the financial resources?
It's a non-issue, right, because the shelters provide housing and clothing and food and everything. You don't have to worry about resources to go to one of our shelters.
Pam Wiseman is the executive director of the New Mexico Coalition Against Domestic Violence. They're on the web at nmcadv.org. And what is the phone number?
It's 505-246-9240.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.